That constant hum, the questions, the worries, maybe sometimes, even outright panic about parenting in this super digital world.
Oh, yeah. I think we all feel that.
It feels like every day there's a new headline, right? Another worry about kids and screens.
Absolutely. And it changes so fast. It's tough for parents to know what's reliable info versus just, opinions flying around.
Exactly. So today we're doing a deep dive. We're going into some really insightful research-backed stuff on parenting in the digital age. We're pulling directly from Professor Jacqueline Nessie's brilliant work, her Substack newsletter, Technosapiens.
Fantastic resource.
Totally. Our mission here is basically to pull out the most important nuggets, the key insights from her work, and give you a shortcut, kind of, to getting well-informed on this really critical topic. So let's get into it.
Okay. So a really key thing Nessie stresses right away is grounding all this advice in understanding adolescence itself.
Right, the teen years.
Yeah, roughly ages 10 to 20. We often think of it as just difficult, challenging.
Yeah, the storm and stress idea.
Exactly. But Nessie's research, and she builds on others like the UCLA Center for the Developing Adolescent, she reframes it. She says these years are actually this unique time of like super fast growth, learning, development. It's a huge opportunity, actually, for adults to help shape who teens become.
That's such an important shift in perspective.
Yeah.
Not just getting through it, but seeing the opportunity.
Right. It's about working with their developmental needs, not, fighting against them.
And she lays out six key scientific needs for teens. That sounds like a really useful framework for parents.
It really is. So first up is exploration and risk-taking.
Okay.
Teen brains are just wired for excitement, for novelty. So the idea is we should encourage healthy risks.
Like what kind of healthy risks?
Well, trying a new sport, maybe taking a tougher class at school, or, using their voice online or offline to stand up for something they believe in, things that feel a bit challenging but are ultimately constructive.
Got it. Okay, what's next?
That leads nicely into the need for meaning and purpose through contribution. As teens develop more empathy, they become really capable of helping others. And this can be simple stuff, like supporting a friend who's having a hard time, maybe online, doing chores at home without being nagged, or getting involved in, say, student government or volunteering. It helps them feel like they matter.
Right, like their actions have impact. That makes sense. Number three.
Decision making and emotional regulation. And I mean, we all know teens feel things so strongly.
Oh, yeah. The highs are high, the lows are low.
Totally. Whether it's excitement over some new trend or just intense frustration about something feeling unfair. So Nessie really highlights teaching them to recognize and manage those big feelings,
How did you do that?
equipping them with healthy coping skills, things like distraction techniques, mindfulness, maybe just listening to music, self-care routines. And crucially, we have to model that stuff ourselves.
Yeah, that's always the hard part, isn't it?
Okay.
Okay, what else?
Then there's support from parents and other caring adults. Even when they act super independent,
Which they do.
they still absolutely need warmth, our interest, and, appropriate structure. That means clear rules, boundaries, and parents basically knowing what's going on in their lives.
Monitoring, yeah.
Right. And having other supportive adults, coaches, teachers, mentors, that's also really vital for them.
Okay, two more.
Fifth is developing values, goals, and identity. They're actively figuring out, who do I want to be?
That's a big question.
It is. And they're influenced by everything: peers, family, community, even random TikTok trends,
Ah, yeah.
So they need some freedom to experiment, but also our support as they explore different parts of their identity, racial, ethnic, gender, sexual identity, helping them do that safely.
Right. And the last one.
Finally, respect and social status. Teen brains become like hyper aware of social standing during these years.
Oh, but
So providing healthy ways for them to gain respect, maybe through school achievements, extracurriculars, or just by treating them like competent people whose opinions actually matter, that's incredibly important for their self-worth.
wow. Okay, so understanding those six needs really does change how you might approach things. But how does this translate to, the everyday screen time arguments?
Well, Nessie says it starts by rethinking what we mean by discipline.
Okay, not just punishment.
Exactly. She defines it as your entire system for teaching kids acceptable behavior. And it's built on three things: warmth, structure, and effective consequences.
Okay, let's break that down. Warmth.
Warmth is pretty straightforward. It's showing affection, support, actively building that positive, loving connection.
So what does that look like?
For little kids, maybe it's dedicated special playtime. For older kids, maybe a movie night or, I don't know, even making a silly TikTok together.
Right.
These moments, she calls them deposits in the bank. They build trust.
I like that. Okay, and structure.
Structure means having consistent, predictable limits, rules, and expectations, and being really clear and specific.
So not just less screen time.
Right. More like, okay, you can play Minecraft for 30 minutes on weekdays, but only after homework's done, and it has to be before 8 p.m., something concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And for older kids, she suggests actually involving them in setting the rules, makes them feel more ownership. It's kind of firm but flexible. You need to know your absolute deal breakers versus the things you'd prefer they didn't do but might negotiate on.
Okay. Warmth, structure,
yeah.
And consequences.
Yeah.
This ties into that learning theory, right?
Exactly. Operant conditioning. Sounds technical, but the basic idea going way back is super simple. Behaviors followed by a good outcome are more likely to happen again.
And ones followed by a bad outcome, less likely.
Precisely. Understanding this is key to guiding kids' behavior online or off.
So Nessie breaks down the types of consequences.
Yeah, there are four main types. First is positive reinforcement, adding something good. Like maybe giving some extra screen time because they finished their chores early without being asked.
Okay. Rewarding good behavior.
Then negative reinforcement. Taking away something bad or annoying. Like maybe lifting a screen time restriction for a bit because they cleaned their room proactively. You're removing a negative rule.
Right. Then there's punishment.
Yeah. Positive punishment is adding something bad. So if they posted something inappropriate, you might add a new rule, like they now need permission before posting anything on TikTok.
Adding a restriction.
And negative punishment is taking away something good. This is probably the most common one parents use, like taking away their phone for the rest of the day because they broke a screen time rule.
Okay, that makes sense. But Nessie points out a common mistake, right?
Yes, a huge one. Sometimes our attention, even if we're scolding or lecturing them, can actually act as positive reinforcement for younger kids. They crave the attention, good or bad.
Oh, interesting. So yelling might accidentally encourage the behavior.
It can, yeah. And also giving in when they escalate, like having a huge tantrum over the iPad and you finally just give it back to make it stop, that reinforces the tantrum itself.
Ugh, been there.
We all have. And related to that, she talks about something called the extinction burst.
The what now?
Extinction burst. It means when you start consistently ignoring an unwanted behavior that used to get attention, like whining, expect it to get worse for a bit before it gets better.
Worse. Oh, great.
I know, but it's actually a sign it might be working. They're trying harder to get the old reaction. Knowing this helps you stay consistent and not give in right when it feels toughest.
Okay, that's actually really helpful to know. It explains a lot about those after-screen meltdowns too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why do kids flip out so much when it's time to turn things off?
Nessie's research points to a few key reasons. I mean, first off, it's just hard to stop doing fun things, right? Screens light up the brain's reward centers.
True.
Also, kids might have temporary problems with executive functions. Switching tasks is hard. Sometimes they might be imitating bad behavior they saw on a show.
Oh, interesting.
Or maybe stopping interrupts their progress in a game, which is super frustrating. Screen time might be replacing needed physical activity. Sometimes it's just overstimulation, or they have these big feelings, excitement, frustration, that don't just switch off.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So knowing why helps us figure out what to do.
Exactly. She offers proactive strategies, like experiment with different types of shows or games. Try different ways of stopping. Give those 5-minute or 2-minute warnings.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to them about the transition. Ask them, hey, why is it sometimes hard to turn off the iPad? Help them build that self-awareness.
What else?
Make a plan together beforehand. Like, okay, we'll watch 2 episodes, then it's off. Think about timing. Maybe don't have screen time right before something demanding. Maybe plan a calm activity after screens.
Good idea.
And the big one, be consistent. Stick to the limits. Even with whining, you can validate their feelings. I know you're disappointed. It's time to stop, but hold the line.
Right. Consistency is key.
Oh, and turn off autoplay. Seriously. If meltdowns are happening all the time, maybe you do need to reduce the overall amount of screen time.
Okay. That consistency point feels really important. Which kind of leads us to some specific digital challenges, right? Like, what about the really little kids, ages 5 and under? The guidelines seem super strict.
They are pretty strict. The AAP and WHO say basically no screens under 18 months except video chat, then 18, 24 months only co-viewing educational stuff, and 2-5 years, an hour or less of high-quality programming.
But the reality is often different.
Very different. Nessie points out that, on average, 2 to 4-year-olds are getting something like 2.5 hours a day.
Wow.
Her take, which I find really helpful, is that the specific hour cutoffs can be a bit arbitrary. The real question is screen time interfering with the absolute essentials for healthy development?
Which are?
Sleep, physical activity, and crucially, that back and forth human interaction. She calls it serve and return.
Serve and return. Like tennis.
Kind of. Imagine a baby babbles or points. The parent serves back by responding, naming the objects, making eye contact. That responsive interaction is fundamental for brain development. Too much passive screen time can get in the way of that.
Got it. So it's about balance and what screen time might be displacing. What about what they watch? Does it have to be educational?
Nessie says developmentally appropriate is key. It doesn't always have to be explicitly educational, but those shows often do have positive messages. She looks for 4 qualities in good shows. They should be active, prompting responses, engaging, holding attention without being overwhelming, meaningful, connecting to their lives, and socially interactive, modeling positive interactions.
Like Daniel Tiger or Sesame Street?
Exactly. Daniel Tiger, Sesame Street, Dora, Super WHY, those kinds of shows often hit those marks.
And do kids actually learn from screens at that age?
Well, Nessie highlights the video deficit. Mm-hmm. Basically, kids under 3 learn way less effectively from a 2D screen compared to a real live person.
Why is that?
A screen can't respond contingently, offer different angles, provide that rich multisensory input like a real person or object can. Once kids are 3 or older, some learning can happen from screens, but it's significantly boosted if you co-view, watch with them, and talk about it.
Okay. And for stopping those screen time battles with little ones, any quick tips?
Yeah, similar ideas. Clear expectations before screens go on. Offer simple choices. Turn it off now or in 2 minutes. Give simple reasons. Time for bath. Use visual timers. Give warnings. Be consistent afterwards. And validate feelings while holding the boundary firm.
Great practical advice. Okay, let's shift gears to something that causes a lot of anxiety. Dopamine. The whole screen addiction fear.
Right. The narrative is often that screens cause these dangerous dopamine surges, just like drugs, leading to addiction.
So what's the reality, according to Nessie's research? What is dopamine doing?
She provides a really important clarification. Dopamine isn't just a pleasure chemical. It's a neurotransmitter involved in lots of things, movement, sleep, learning. But its main role here is motivation. It drives us to seek out rewarding things.
So screens are rewarding.
Yes. Like many enjoyable activities, dopamine gets released. And social media platforms especially are designed very cleverly. Features like endless scrolling, unpredictable likes that creates what scientists call variable reward schedules. It leverages that dopamine response to keep us engaged, keep us coming back.
But is it really addiction, like drug addiction?
Nessie is clear. For most people, no, it's not comparable. Problematic, maybe even addictive-like use can happen for a small percentage of kids, but currently, there's no official diagnosis like social media addiction in the main diagnostic manuals.
Okay, so the takeaway for parents.
Don't panic about dopamine specifically. Focus instead on promoting moderation, ensuring screens aren't crowding out other rewarding activities, playing outside, hanging out with friends in person, hobbies, all that stuff. Aim for balance.
That's a much calmer perspective. We can talk video games. They're everywhere, right? Especially for boys.
Almost universal. Like 97% of teen boys, 83% of teen girls play. And yeah, boys average way more time over 2 hours a day compared to under an hour for girls.
Are they inherently bad? What does the research say?
Generally, Nessie finds little evidence of inherent harm from gaming itself. In fact, there are some cognitive benefits linked to certain types of games, things like better working memory, faster reaction times, improved attention skills.
And socially.
They can be a really important social space, particularly for boys, a way to connect, cooperate, compete with friends.
But the big question is always, when is it too much?
Yeah, and Nessie brings it back to that key question. What are the games replacing?
Right.
If gaming is consistently pushing out sleep, homework, physical activity, face-to-face socializing, that's when you need to be concerned.
What about actual gaming disorder? Is that a real thing?
It is. It's characterized by things like losing control over gaming, giving it increasing priority over everything else, and continuing to game despite negative consequences. It affects maybe 1 to 9% of teens. If you're seriously worried about that pattern, seeking professional advice is the way to go.
Okay. And the elephant in the room, violent video games. Mm. Are they dangerous? The debate is so heated.
It is. Nessie presents a nuanced view based on the bulk of research. Studies do show small, short-term increases in aggressive thoughts, feelings, and maybe behaviors right after playing.
Okay, small and short term.
Right. But there's very little evidence linking violent game playing to long-term serious violence or criminal behavior. That connection is often overstated in the media.
So how should parents handle violent games then?
Nessie gives 5 key pieces of advice. 1, know the research, understand the nuance, the short-term versus long-term findings. 2, know your child, how's their temperament, who are their friends. 3, know the games, actually play with them or watch, check ratings on sites like Common Sense Media. 4, talk about it. Discuss your family values, your concerns about the content. And 5, set flexible limits. Use that collaborative, autonomy-supportive approach. Involve them in setting boundaries around what they play and when.
That seems really balanced. Okay, one more big debate area. Phones in schools. Why are schools considering bans?
Well, the reasons are pretty clear. Worries about distraction, interfering with learning, potential negative impacts on social skills like less face-to-face interaction, cyberbullying concerns, and general worries about mental health.
And what does the research say? Are phones actually distracting?
Oh, yeah. The research is pretty solid on that. Smartphones are distracting. Even just having one nearby, even if it's off, can impact attention and performance on cognitive tasks.
Okay, so they're distracting. But do bans actually work? Does banning phones improve things?
That's where the evidence gets a bit more mixed, according to Nessie. Some studies, like one in England, found small but significant improvements in test scores after bans, especially for lower-achieving students.
Okay, so some positive effect there.
But other studies, in places like Norway and Sweden, found minimal or no impact overall, or maybe effects only for certain student groups.
So it's not a simple bans work or bans don't work.
Exactly. Nessie suggests that limiting phone use during the school day makes logical sense to reduce distraction. But the details really matter. How is the ban enforced? Do teachers have support? It's not a magic bullet.
Right. A phone ban isn't going to solve the entire youth mental health crisis on its own.
Precisely. There are many factors involved in student well-being at school, and phones are just one piece of a much larger puzzle.
Okay, this is all incredibly helpful context. Let's pivot now to some really practical tools.
Yeah.
The number one question I hear is, when is the right age to get a kid a smartphone?
And Ness's answer, maybe frustratingly for some, is there's no single right age.
Huh. Yeah, I figured.
Her general advice, based on the evidence of potential interference with social skills and academics, especially for younger teens, is to wait if you can. Delaying is often beneficial.
But how do you know if your kid is ready?
She offers a great framework called the 4 R's to help parents think it through.
Okay, what are they?
Responsibility. Does your child generally show responsibility in other areas of their life? Do they understand what it means to be responsible with a device? Rules. Do they understand the rules you'll set and why those rules exist? Risks. Do they have a basic understanding of potential online risks, like privacy issues or cyberbullying? And reasons. What are their actual reasons for wanting a phone? Is it genuine need or just peer pressure?
Yeah, it's a really useful checklist. What if you decide they're not ready for a smartphone or you just want alternatives?
Nessie mentioned several options. There are basic phones. Yeah, flip phones still exist.
Wow.
There are also these minimalist, kid-friendly smartphones like Gab, Pinwheel, or Bark phones, which have limited functionality. And smartwatches can be a good intermediate step, too, allowing calls and texts with approved contacts, but no internet browser or apps.
Okay, good options. So let's say they have the phone. Now, boundaries and parental controls. Nessie has some specific rules she recommends.
Yes, some really actionable ones. First and foremost, no phone in the bedroom, especially at night. Sleep is just too important.
Absolutely critical.
Second, establish at least one other phone-free zone or time. Maybe family meals, maybe car rides.
Oh.
Third, require permission before downloading new apps or making in-app purchases. Avoid surprise bills. Fourth, talk constantly about using good judgment, being kind online, choosing positive content, thinking before they post. And fifth, a simple one. They need to respond to texts or calls from parents reasonably promptly.
That seems fair. What about the technical side parental controls? Are they effective?
Nessie has a great analogy. Parental controls are like a gate, not a wall.
A gate, not a wall. I like that.
Yeah. They're useful for slowing kids down, creating barriers, making it harder to access inappropriate stuff or spend too much time. But they're not foolproof. Determined kids can often find workarounds.
So don't just set them and forget them.
Definitely not. The crucial thing Nessie emphasizes is that setting controls needs to be an ongoing conversation. Sit down with your child, explain why you're setting certain limits, listen to their perspective, and adjust the controls together as they get older and show more responsibility.
Can you give some examples of the kinds of controls available?
Sure. On Instagram, for instance, teen accounts default to private now, and there are restrictions on who can message them. Parents can use the supervision tools to see who they follow and who follows them, who they message, not the content, and set daily time limits.
Okay. What about TikTok?
TikTok has different settings for younger teens, 13 to 15, versus older ones, 16, 17, regarding things like direct messages and comments. They also have family pairing, which lets a parent link their account to manage settings, including screen time.
And Snapchat. Seems like a tricky one.
Snapchat also has settings to limit contact from strangers for teens. Their family center lets parents see their child's friends list and who they've messaged recently. Again, not the content, but just the contacts, which gives some oversight. YouTube offers YouTube Kids for the youngest. For older kids, there are supervised accounts parents can manage, allowing them to choose content levels, block channels, turn off search, and see watch history. There's also a general restricted mode filter.
And then just the phone's operating system itself.
Right. Both Android with Google Family Link and iOS with Apple Family Sharing and Screen Time have built-in tools. You can set time limits for specific apps or overall usage, approve app downloads, track location, and filter web content.
So many tools.
Lots of tools. But the key, as Nessie stresses again and again, is that the technology is only part of it. The conversations, the warmth, the structure, that's the foundation.
Wow. We have really covered a huge amount of ground today. It's incredible how much insight is packed into Professor Nessie's Technosapiens work, from understanding how teens tick to these really concrete strategies for screens.
Absolutely. It really underscores that idea of evidence-based parenting. Nessie often talks about it like a three-legged stool.
Oh.
Yeah. The research, like everything we've discussed today, that's one crucial leg. But the other two legs are just as important. Your own unique expertise as a parent who knows your child best, and your child's individual characteristics, their temperament, their strengths, their challenges.
So the science gives us direction, but we still need to use our judgment.
Exactly. The research provides the map, maybe, but you are the one driving, adapting to the specific terrain of your family and your child. Your informed judgment makes it work.
That's a really empowering way to think about it. It leads to a final thought, maybe, for everyone listening.
Yeah, perhaps something to mull over. In this world where digital tech just keeps changing so fast, how can you shift from just reacting to the latest crisis or headline?
Yeah.
How can you proactively take these kinds of evidence-based insights we've talked about and use them to really shape a digital environment at home that doesn't just help your kids survive, but actually helps them thrive?